Congressman Jerry Connolly, it's a pleasure to be here in your office. Thank
Great
you for
to be back,
hosting
Mr.
me. The talk, of course, as you get back to work this week, is what's happening with budget and sequester and shutdown and appropriations. My audience tells me over and over again those are the things that they worry about, the lack of clarity particularly. What do you know and what do you hear and what do you expect to happen in the coming days, sir?
I think the Congress reconvenes after the August recess with enormous uncertainty. I don't think anybody knows how we're going to get on a path to full funding of the government in the next 12 legislative days. That's going to be an enormous challenge for Republican leadership. Both Speaker Boehner and Leader McConnell have said they by no means want to see another shutdown. But I don't think that's reflective of sort of the far right of their base. So you have people like Jim Jordan here in the House of Ohio saying, frankly, defunding of Planned Parenthood is worth shutting down the government. You've got Ted Cruz in the Senate saying the same over there. And so will the two leaders be able to muster a majority coalition to fund the government and avoid another shutdown? And I think that's the, $64 million question.
Mm-hmm. As this,
or maybe I should say the $2 trillion
that's
question.
Exactly right. As this plays out in the coming days and weeks, are there markers that you're following that you, if someone does something or gives way on something or anything like that, that you're paying attention to? Or is it really just as things happen minute by minute and we have to just respond to what we see?
I think it's much more the latter. There is no clear path. There's no obvious strategy. Mm-hmm. And so I would predict that, again, sort of at the 11th hour, we will be asked to vote on something. And I would predict that something will require an overwhelming majority of Democrats and a substantial minority of Republicans to pass. Mm-hmm. And that is the dilemma for Speaker Boehner. Every time he does that, he gets weaker in his own caucus. And as you know, he's got hanging over his head right now a resolution, not yet privileged, to declare his seat, his speaker seat, vacant. And so if this doesn't go the way the right wing wants it to go, I think he faces a real challenge to his speakership legislatively. Mm-hmm. We've got that dynamic as well. So this is not going to be an easy path at all. And I don't think you can rule out, unfortunately, the prospect of another shutdown.
So I want to come back to the shutdown topic in a moment, but you raised the subject of Speaker Boehner's speakership. That resolution is being brought by a colleague of yours. You're the ranking member of the Government Operations Subcommittee on Oversight and Government Reform. The chairman of that committee is Mark Meadows. He's bringing that resolution. I'm not going to ask you to step into the Republicans' political debate, but your relationship with Chairman Meadows is what, would you say?
We're friends. We're good colleagues. We consult with each other on the business of the subcommittee. Obviously, he doesn't seek my advice on broader political questions within his caucus. We're very different people. I'm a progressive Democrat. He's a very conservative Republican. But we do share a sense of decency and civility that needs to be returned to the Congress. And I think Mark sincerely wants to get something done while he's here in Congress. And that's the party I belong to, the Get It Done party. Mm-hmm. and so we've found common ground on a lot of issues, and we've been very cooperative in how we work out the work schedule and the agenda for the subcommittee. Mm-hmm. We don't want surprises for each other. I don't have to read about what he's planning, and likewise, he doesn't have to read about my critique. It's been a very good and cordial relationship. And I genuinely believe Mark, his philosophical orientation notwithstanding, would like to actually improve how the federal government works rather than tear it down.
So there's then at least one person in the Republican caucus that the federal workforce, your constituents and my audience, can look to as kind of a beacon of hope that the bashing will at least stop at his office door.
I think there's a good chance of that. That's right. I mean, I don't want to pretend Mark
sure.
isn't a founder of the Freedom Caucus. He's among the more conservative Republicans there are. He has introduced this resolution to dethrone Speaker Boehner. Mm-hmm. All of that's true. But I don't think that means that he simply wants to make a point while being here. Actually, I think Mark wants to be the author of serious legislation that would positively impact how the federal government is run, and by extension would be solicitous of federal employees and the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the shutdown talk, because that is doesn't seem to be as high profile among the people that I talked to in the agencies as it was 2 years ago when it actually happened. A lot of people seem to be not sure 100% yet, but believing Speaker Boehner, Leader McConnell, when they say there's not going to be one this time around. Are they maybe getting a little too comfortable?
I think that would be a fair statement. Their statements notwithstanding, it's not clear that they're going to be able to control their own caucus. And this latest set of issues with respect to Planned Parenthood adds more fuel to the fire on the right, mm-hmm. and gives them a new hope. And so they're going to make any budget funding contingent on defunding Planned Parenthood. And obviously on our side of the aisle, that is an unacceptable proposition, and likewise the president.
Is that the only deal killer that you see on the horizon right now? I understand you can't speak to every single one that could potentially come up between now and September 30th, but of the issues that everybody seems to be focused on right now, that seems to be the one that people are focused on today as the one that could do a deal in.
I think that is the most prominent and available one, but there are lots of other potential deal killers. Mm-hmm. Who knows what kinds of riders my friends on the other side of the aisle may want to attach to the budget, and both our side of the aisle and the president will find unacceptable. Mm-hmm. So we need a clean CR with fair and reasonable funding levels, and I don't see why that's a difficult challenge, but in the current climate, it is.
The White House and the leaders on the Republican side, both Senate and House, were speaking about the parameters of a CR during the recess. Is that an encouragement to you, or does that not make one much of a difference one way or the other?
I think the Republican leadership gets it, that this didn't work out so well last time, and we don't want the Ted Cruz's of the world basically being the voice in the face of our caucus, because it does damage to our reputation for our ability to govern. And so it's going to be a real test of their leadership.
Jerry, we are now learning more about the results of the 30-day cyber sprint from the Office of Management and Budget, and we're seeing guidance for the agencies on how they're expected to implement FITARA. You obviously instrumental in getting that written and passed. Do you like what you're seeing out of OMB about how they're asking the agencies and telling the agencies they expect them to implement your legislation?
Tony Scott and OMB have been phenomenal in their support for FITARA. In sharp contrast to earlier, when I was trying to get the bill passed, OMB stood in the sidelines with Steve Inrochel, and we were really disappointed in that. It's a total different regime. It's night and day right now, and OMB has been the strongest proponent of utilizing FITARA as a management tool, as something that can help you as an agency better cope with budget constraints, personnel constraints, and take you to the next plateau technologically. So we're using technology as a transformative process, mm-hmm. rather than just another commodity to be purchased and managed.
You think there was a mind shift inside OMB, or is it just a difference between the goals that Steve Inrochel had as opposed to the goals that Tony Scott has? Or what do you think that transformation was about?
I think definitely new leadership at OMB took a fresh look at this and really saw its enormous promise. Mm-hmm. We're talking about saving billions of dollars a year, maybe a lot more than that over time. But more importantly, how can we use technology to better achieve our objectives agency by agency, make ourselves more efficient, but also, almost exponentially change how we deliver services and how we organize ourselves and how we are marshaled to address issues and challenges. Technology can can be so transformative. And so that's really the underlying goal of FITAR. Mm-hmm. It isn't to be another, you know, compendium of regulations and requirements on a federal manager. It's actually to give him or her some new tools with which to change how they do business for the better. Yeah. And it can be win-win. We upgrade your technology, we make you more efficient and more efficacious in how you deliver services, and we help you save money. Mm-hmm. That's win-win-win.
One of the interesting sidelights of this that I've heard from people who are both still in the technology shops at agencies and from former CIOs who are looking at this authority and saying, boy, I wish I would have had that, is a transformation in the type of person who becomes and continues to be a chief information officer
exactly.
in the government.
Exactly. You know, when we wrote the bill, we discovered that spread out over 24 federal agencies, there were 250 people plus with the title CIO. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go to any corporate CEO and say, how many CIOs does your company have? They look at you like, what a strange question. They go, well, one.
Of course.
And so when you look at what we've got in the federal family, it's really inefficient. And it's designed to make sure there's no accountability, right? That was the other CIO. That wasn't me or you.
Right.
And what our bill did was not to codify one, but it was to create a hierarchical structure that eventually will lead to that. Mm-hmm. But we respect the cultures, the different cultures, different missions, both among and between federal agencies. But we want to get us to the point where we actually have somebody with that title where the buck stops mm-hmm. and who is empowered to make decisions, to award contracts, to really – and pull the plug when they're not working. Mm-hmm. And I'm very impressed with the enthusiasm, and we're still at the early stages here of implementation, that this whole process has addressed. I've spoken to several federal conferences just before, well, actually after recess began, and I was so impressed with how sincerely federal managers are approaching this, and that's great.
The other side benefit to that may be the kind of person who self-selects and decides he or she isn't in the game for that
right.
kind of business anymore.
There are a lot of things our bill did not really address directly. Now, the CIOs, we did. But if this is going to work, we've got to change the paradigm for procurement and project management in the federal government. So if you have a large systems integration technology contract, I don't want to see those project managers change every 6 months. I want you to stick with it. I want you to see it through. I want you to be imbued with a sense of ownership. You're the major stakeholder. Now, that means a cultural shift. It means we have to make that career path a lot sexier than it has been in the past. Mm-hmm. We have to address this turnover problem. We also need to be able to recruit younger and more skilled workers for the future, and that's going to be very, very difficult. Given all that's happening, if you are an expert in this field, your prospects in the private sector at the starting gate are always going to be brighter than in the public sector. And so we're going to have to compensate for that. But hopefully our bill encourages federal agencies to create that new path, career path, and that environment that would do just that.
So FITAR is law now, implementation's underway. What did you learn from the process of getting to where you are today about what you need to do to continue to educate your colleagues about issues like federal acquisition, information technology, and the state of its art in the government and that kind of thing?
Well, you know, we had no trouble getting this bill passed unanimously out of our committee. And we had not too much difficulty actually getting it to the floor and passed almost unanimously, if not unanimously, multiple times here in the House. But getting the Senate to act took, you know, several Congresses. Mm-hmm. And frankly, what really galvanized opinion was the rather disastrous rollout of the health reform website. Mm-hmm. because all of a sudden it focused attention in a very public way on the very thing we were talking about. So what seemed an arcane and technical topic suddenly had policy relevance. A whole set of healthcare reforms could collapse because of the Achilles heel of the technology piece and how it was managed or not. And so that made the case for us in a pretty compelling way when we needed it in the Senate. I wish we could have avoided it, but it was a pretty cogent and salient reminder for colleagues, especially in the other body, that this was a critical topic. It may not be the sexiest of topics. It's not a, it's not going to get you on the Sunday morning news shows, but it is pretty critical as we move the federal government forward.
Another piece of legislation that impacts agencies quite a bit is the Data Act. What do you think of what you're seeing so far on the rollout of the Data Act?
You know, I think similarly, there is a sense of enthusiasm and sense of potential. And I, again, credit OMB with its leadership, because if OMB isn't pushing it, you know, federal managers don't see it as a priority. Why should they? And so I think both the Data Act and our act, the FITAR Act, will have some very positive impacts on the federal government within the next, you know, few years, really. I mean, I think some of the impacts are going to be seen as fairly quickly and as quite substantial.
Cybersecurity, of course, is an important element of information technology in the government. I imagine you heard a little bit about the OPM breach and its impact on people during the recess era.
Oh, yes. You know, I think there are two aspects of this. One is the immediate need to make the federal employee who is, after all, the victim here, priority number one. Mm-hmm. I've conveyed that to the new acting head of OPM, and I think she gets that. And that means we do everything in our power to protect them, to extend protection, and to make sure that the mechanisms are working so that if people have questions or they need to sign up for that protection, that's done in a very expeditious way, which was not the case immediately following the breach. There were people who waited 2 hours or had to call back multiple times and didn't always get consistent answers. Not everybody, even to this day, has been formally notified that, in fact, they're part of the breach. That's got to be focused on. But secondly, longer term, the federal government has to organize itself to protect itself. And OPM breach is just the latest reminder of just how vulnerable the systems are. Now, Congress bears some responsibility here. If you've been disinvesting in infrastructure and resources, both personnel and technical, how can you be surprised that an agency that has multiple systems, legacy systems, vulnerable systems, systems that are impervious to encryption because they're so old, suddenly finds itself vulnerable to hacking from anybody, let alone a systematic attempt at hacking by a foreign government, or at least elements sponsored by a foreign government? And that's pretty clear in this case. So now we have 22 million people whose private information, personal information, has been compromised. And that's, you know, that's going to continue until we reorganize ourselves to take the cyber threat very seriously. We ought to take that as seriously a threat as any threat we faced during the Cold War.
Some of the unions and other employee advocacy groups have called for identity protection to become part of the benefit portfolio in government. Is that something that you would support and be able to push legislation?
Absolutely. Laws? Nobody wants to come and work for any agency or entity, private or public, knowing that if anything goes wrong with respect to the information we've actually required of you, you're on your own. And I think that would be a perfectly sensible and indeed advantageous addition to the package that is offered a prospective employee.
The pay raise is an issue that we talked about a little bit when we discussed the issues with the budget and shutdown and so on. 1.3% for civilian and for uniformed military personnel. What kind of a review did that get when you went out to your constituents over the recess?
Well, I think that after, you know, a long drought, federal employees are, you know, grateful for some recognition. As you know, I've authored legislation to make it 3%, and I'm disappointed it's not that. I think so are my constituents. At least it's some progress. But I don't think we should settle for that over the long term. I think we have to recognize that pay scales have to stay competitive. We were just talking about technology. How will you possibly attract people who could command, you know, six-figure salaries from day one in the private sector to the public sector? And it's not like we don't need them. The OPM breach, cybersecurity threats, the website rollout for the healthcare reform, all of them underscore how important technical expertise is. Well, you've got to be willing to pay market competitive salaries and compensation if you want to attract that talent to the federal government.
Is it time then to kind of revamp the way that the government hires and manages its workforce entirely? Because I think of a proposal that I've seen recently for being able to fast track employees in to the IT sectors, to the efforts that the digital services group is making at OMB, 18F at the General Services Administration. There are others all across government. But it seems to me that might then become slippery slopes, a negative term. This seems like a positive effort to get people in faster.
Yeah.
But people start asking for exemptions, and I want to take advantage of that to the point that everybody wants to take advantage of that, and the old system and the new system kind of coexist in this weird, bizarro world almost. It seems that the only way around that is to start to really work at this in a methodical, strategic way.
I do think that you know, we need to be looking at an overhaul of how we hire and promote within the federal system. We want to make sure that protections are built in so that there isn't discrimination, de facto discrimination, that there isn't cronyism. After all, the civil service was created to respond to widespread cronyism and nepotism and favoritism in the 19th century. And so we have to be cognizant of those concerns that are with us today. But we live in a modern world where workforces have to be agile and flexible, and you've got to have the tools to differentiate among skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
So the skill set you need to be, you know, a draftsman in an engineering shop is different, and the compensation required to attract you is different than high-skilled technologists who can take us to the next plateau in the deployment of high tech. So I think we have work to do in trying to reform a system that still very much maintains a lot of vestiges from the 19th century, all for good reasons, mm-hmm. all well-motivated. And you know, they worked more or less for a long time. That doesn't mean you junk the whole system, but I think we ought to be open to a fresh reform overhaul that makes it, as I said, a more agile workforce and that can compete with the private sector in the 21st century.
A couple of particular agencies I'd like to ask you about to close up, sir. The Internal Revenue Service, Commissioner Koskinen's been on the Hill many, many times, talking about his frustration with his funding level, how small, in his view, the agency's budget has gotten in the past 5 years. Do you see any hope for that changing anytime soon? And do you see any hope, if that situation doesn't change, for the service to be able to offer better service to its customers?
You know, here's a good example where my friends on the other side of the aisle have allowed their ideology to trump any kind of consistency, let alone pragmatism, with respect to the IRS. They don't like the IRS. It is, for them, the embodiment of big government, and it's hobnail boot on the neck of all Americans. And yet, in the same breath, they'll decry the size of the federal debt. There's only one agency in the federal family that can really address in a strong and significant way the federal debt, and that is the IRS. We know that every dollar we invest in the IRS has, you know, many multitudes of return, and it's one of the most efficient things we can do to bring in revenue that's owed And it's estimated we leave somewhere north of $350 billion a year. That's billion a year on the table, uncollected, because IRS doesn't have the resources. Not new taxes, legitimate obligations to the federal government in the tax code that are left on the table. Mm-hmm. Now, over a 10-year period, that's $3.5 trillion. Now, sequestration, about which we're all concerned, is $1.2 trillion. So this dwarfs that. We could take care of sequestration and make a very significant down payment on reducing the national debt if we simply put aside ideology and gave the IRS the resources it needs. John Koskinen is one of the most honorable civil servants I've ever known. And I've known him going all the way back to 1999, when he was the czar of the year 2000, when we worried about a different technology challenge, the potential crash when that clock turned at midnight. And he did a wonderful job then, and he came out of retirement to try to help the IRS. And, of course, he's been pilloried for it by what I consider to be a very ignoble campaign because they just don't like the IRS. But he points out that the average computer, average, is 7 to 8 years old in the IRS. Now, in the private sector, computers are generally replaced every 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you have hard drive crashes. And with a workforce of 91,000 people, the direction to IRS in archiving material is, quote, print and save. When I tell this to corporate execs, they roll their eyes. They can't believe it. Mm-hmm. That's what we're reduced to. So they have degraded the ability of the IRS to serve, whether it be technology, whether it be archiving and retrieving material, whether it be the ability to, frankly, man phone banks to answer taxpayer questions. And all of it cynically designed to then erode public confidence in this agency and say, see, we told you the IRS doesn't work. Well, of course it doesn't, because you've defunded it. You've disinvested it. I believe these Congresses have cut the IRS by about 19%. I think it's over $1 billion of funding. That $1 billion, had it not been cut, probably would have brought in 20 or 30 at least billion dollars of additional tax revenue to help us fund the government and to address things like sequestration. And it's really a sorry chapter where ideology has been allowed to trump everything, including common sense, and the ultimate losers are the American taxpayers.
Speaking of sorry chapters, I'll close with some commiseration with you. As an Orioles fan, I'm sorry to see that we're both looking up at the Yankees in the standings as the season comes to an end. I'm sitting underneath your Red Sox sign.
Well, we Red Sox fans are patient people. And
you have to be.
We have to be. But you know what? That patience pays off now and then.
It does.
So in my lifetime, we've won the World Series twice. And we Red Sox fans are always generous. We wish everyone, including the Orioles, well. We hope the Cubs win the World Series. There's just sort of one team we don't feel so fondly about. I think you've named them.
It's great to see you, Jerry. Thank
Likewise,
you for your time
Francis.
Today.
Thanks for having me.